Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Mike McPherson. I'm from the University of Virginia, also on the program committee for EDUCAUSE 2013. Welcome to Friday, the last day of this conference. It's been a great week, and we're looking forward to another fantastic morning. Welcome also to the online participants on campuses all over the world. We're happy to have you with us. This is an online part of the online program, so if you have questions during the Q&A period, please come to the microphone, speak clearly, and identify yourself before you ask your question. Also, I want to put in a plug, as someone who reviewed a lot of proposals for this conference, please, we would love for you to fill out the evaluation. You can use the mobile app. You can get on the website. The evaluation process this year is streamlined, so it'll only take you a minute or so to do an evaluation, and we really use those. We pay attention to them when we select proposals for these conferences. I would like, I'm very pleased today to introduce our speaker, Pam Samuelson. Sorry, having trouble with my tongue this morning. Pam is the Richard M. Sherman Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. She has a joint appointment in the School of Information at Berkeley as well. She has a long history with copyright and other legal issues surrounding technology and is widely considered to be an expert on the subject. Before she went to Berkeley, she held appointments at a number of other leading universities, and before that practiced law in the private world. So she's been at this a long time. I'm really looking forward to hearing to what she has to say, so let's go ahead and start. Pam?
Well, thank you very much for having me, first of all. Second of all, thanks for getting up early. This is an early morning session, and I'm going to try to be lively because I know that everybody's a little bit asleep now. And thank you to the online folks. I'm glad you're here too. And so please, if you have questions, as the session proceeds, I'd be happy to address them too. I thought it would be a good idea to give you a little overview about where we are going over the next so many minutes. I'm going to talk a little bit about copyright in historical perspective, then talk a little bit about why copyright has become so much more salient to higher education in the current environment. I'll talk a little bit about some of the lawsuits that are pending before federal courts right now and how some of those cases impact higher education. There's also a proposal now for a next great copyright act. The Copyright Office and the Department of Commerce are thinking about and how that will affect higher ed will be something that I'll talk about a little bit too. And finally, I'll talk a little bit about ways in which open access seems to promise to solve some of our problems and talk about some of the opportunities and obstacles that open access provides. So that's the kind of roadmap of where we're going. So I'm going to mostly talk here about U.S. law, because that's what I know the best, but most of the comments that I'm making are applicable to copyright laws outside the United States. But one thing that was different about U.S. law was that until the 1976 Copyright Act, in the United States, and this wasn't so true for other countries, copyright was really an opt-in regime. That is to say, people would write works, texts, and would create images and would do other things, and they could copyright them, but copyright didn't attach automatically by operation of law. And so when you published a work, if you didn't put a copyright notice on it, then people could assume that actually the work is in the public domain. So you had to opt in to copyright by putting copyright notices on things and registering with the Copyright Office if, for example, you wanted a second term of copyright. So duration was also much more modest in length. Today, the copyrights in the United States last for life of the author plus 70 years. In most other countries, it's life of the author plus 50 years. So copyright terms are really long these days. Under the law prior to the 1976 Act, the term of copyright was 28 years and then was renewable for another 28 years after that. But most copyrights were not renewed. So if the rules that were in place in 1975 were still in place now, then all works before written and or published before 1957 and most works published before 1985 would be in the public domain, only they aren't now. So at the moment, it's only works that are were created prior to 1923 that are reliably in the public domain. Some works, actually many works created between 1923 and 1963 are also in the public domain because most of them didn't renew copyrights for those terms. The problem is the Copyright Office has really lousy records about that, and so we don't know which works of those many that were created in that time period are in the public domain or not. It's also the case that for higher education, a public performance like a professor standing up in a class or someone giving a lecture at a university, a public performance, even of a dramatic play in a kind of university setting, would not have been deemed something that the copyright law would reach because it was only public performances for profit that actually were copyright controlled. And what's often called the first sale or exhaustion of rights doctrine allowed libraries to lend books to students, faculty, and other researchers. So what is this first sale principle? The copyright owner has the right to control the distribution of copies to the public, but upon the first sale of a copy of a work to the public, that right to control distribution is exhausted by that first sale. And so the person who owns the personal property rights in that copy then can lend it out, can resell it, and the like. And that's why we have bookstores, and that's why we have libraries that can lend or otherwise dispose of works. And some of the copying that students did, some of the copying that professors did, some of the copying that that administrators might do was covered by this concept of fair use that I'll talk about a little bit later. So fair use didn't have to cover a lot of copying during periods of time when reprography technology was really awful. But of course, it got better and better and better. And so part of what we're grappling with now is it's so easy to make a copy. It's so cheap to make a copy. And so copyright, which does regulate copying, now comes to the fore more than it did before. Now, the big deal issue in the 1960s, 1970s, and in, somewhat to, into the 1980s was photocopying, and now that just seems like yesterday's problem, but the law was grappling with this problem for a long time. There was, prior to the 1976 Copyright Act, a kind of gentleman's agreement between certain publishers and higher education and libraries about photocopying a little bit was okay, but what happened in the late 1960s, early 1970s was a publisher of medical texts, of medical journals, sued the United States government for a copyright infringement because the NIH was operating a library service whereby researchers working under NIH grants could come to the library and say, I need a photocopy of this particular article for my research project, and then the library would make copies of that particular research article, and they had a service that they provided to people, and they didn't let you copy everything that you might want, but they had a kind of policy that allowed a reasonable amount of copying from that, and the NIH believed, and the U.S. defended, that that was fair use. The publisher argued that, in fact, that was not fair use. That was infringement. We want to license this use. And so the case went to the courts, and an appellate court ruled by a 4-3 decision, in other words, this is really close, that NIH's photocopying of research articles for patrons was fair use. Williams and Wilkins took it to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court split 4-4, again, signaling that this was actually a pretty close question at the time. The way that the Supreme Court rules work is that if they split 4-4 like they did in this case, the lower court ruling is affirmed, but it just doesn't set a precedent. So Williams and Wilkins then made the libraries at universities all over the world, or at least the U.S., to feel like they could make photocopies for patrons, and that practice continued for a long time. Now, the 1976 Act, which is still in force, changed a lot of the rules of copyright. Now it's an opt-out regime, so that copyright attaches automatically by operation of law to all works from the first fixation in a tangible medium. It's now got a much longer duration of protection, and the public performance right got broader, so that while there's an exception for face-to-face teaching, so that most works, not motion pictures, but most works can actually be performed in a classroom setting without getting copyright permission. But again, the public performance right broadening means that we have to sort of think differently. If it's not a face-to-face teaching, if it's long-distance teaching, if it's MOOCs, then different rules may apply. Fair use and the first sale rule were codified. Libraries and archives got some special rules that enable them to do certain kinds of copies for stated purposes. There was an effort to get a kind of broad educational use exception in the course of the legislative history. That was not successful. There was, however, a set of classroom guidelines that were negotiated between publishers and libraries, but they were pretty restricted, and although many educators thought that the classroom guidelines were just a floor, and then you could claim fair use on top of that, sometimes those classroom guidelines have been offered as though they're really a ceiling and that anything outside of the classroom guidelines is actually not fair use. And there were a number of issues that were spun off to a special commission to think about interlibrary loans and digitizing books and the like. So fair use is a concept that I'm going to spend some time on. Fair uses are not infringements. That's what the statute says. They're not excused infringements. They're just not infringements. And four factors are typically considered in making a judgment about whether something is a fair use or not. So the purpose of the defendant's use is one factor. The nature of the copyrighted work is a second factor. The amount and substantiality of the taking is a third factor, and the harm to actual or foreseeable potential markets is a fourth factor. The statute holds out research, scholarship, and teaching as actually favored fair uses, but it's also clear that productive uses, or what the Supreme Court calls transformative uses, are more valued than consumptive uses. And let me just illustrate the difference. So a productive use might be a scholar writing a paper quoting from a pre-existing work in order to make a new work that comments on the work that the other guy did. A consumptive use is really a use where you're consuming it for the same purpose as you have you would if you had just purchased a copy. And so productive uses are more valued by society because then we're getting a new work of authorship that essentially builds on pre-existing work. So one of the big battlegrounds after the Williams and Wilkins case was the American Geophysical Union versus Texaco case decided by the Second Circuit in 1995. Texaco had research scientists who were essentially getting journals, technical journals about things that were relevant to their research, circulated, and then they would make photocopies of some articles from individual journals and keep them in their files. And so Texaco argued, largely relying on the Williams and Wilkins case, that this was a fair use. It was for research purposes. It was not the photocopying was not being done because of the brilliant prose in the articles, but more in terms of the I want to get access to the information that these articles contain, and the information is not protected by copyright law. And you know, we're already subscribing to these journals, so the journals are getting fair compensation. But the appellate court in this particular case decided that Texaco research scientists copying was not fair use. It was not productive use, it was consumptive use, because they were just keeping copies of the whole article and doing it on a systematic basis. The argument that it was hard to kind of negotiate with all the publishers out there for licenses to make these copies, that market failure was cured by Copyright Clearance Center licensing. And I'm going into some detail about this because some of the cases that are pending before the courts right now are ones in which Copyright Clearance Center wants very much to license certain uses. Although for photocopying of research articles in universities, there was no follow-up lawsuit to Texaco. The CoursePack cases that were brought against Kinko's and some other services that were essentially facilitating the development of CoursePacks went against the CoursePack developers, and the Copyright Clearance Center now licenses those uses because they were not fair either. So there are four or five cases pending right now or that have recently been decided that actually have a big impact on universities. The first one that I'll focus on is the Cambridge University Press versus Becker case. This case is being litigated by Cambridge University Press, Oxford University Press, and Sage Publications, but the expenses for it are being paid half by the Association of American Publishers and half by the Copyright Clearance Center on the hope that if the uses that are at stake are deemed unfair, then the Copyright Clearance Center will have leverage to get license fees from all universities who are doing things like Georgia State. So Becker is one of the employees of Georgia State University. Georgia State University has a policy that allows faculty members to, after going over a kind of fair use checklist, to put up to 10% of a work or one chapter of a book on electronic course reserves that's behind a password-protected wall, so only the students can get access to it. The overwhelming majority of those, the works that are at issue in this particular case are things that are supplementary readings. They're not the required reading, so the faculty members are assigning books and other materials that they have gotten permission for. They haven't sought permission for these electronic course reserve materials. Becker has raised a fair use defense, and in a 350-page opinion, a judge ruled that most of the copying that had been done under this policy was fair use. Cambridge University Press has appealed, and a number of amicus briefs have been filed in the case, and now it is pending before an appellate court. And the oral argument has not, so far as I know, been held yet. So the argument here on Becker's part is that I'm making educational non-commercial uses of this material, the nature of the works, most were written to promote learning, not to make money. And so authors would be happy, actually, to have their materials used. The amount is insubstantial, according to Becker, and there's no existing convenient licensing scheme to do this, so there's really no harm to the market for the work. Cambridge University Press, not surprisingly, has a completely different view on this. They look at this and say it's non-transformative, it's consumptive, therefore that counts against fair use. The texts were created and disseminated for educational markets, and therefore you're interfering with our ability to recoup our investment. Substantial amounts are taken, often the heart of the work. So copyright cases sometimes take into account qualitative substantiality in addition to quantitative substantiality. And their argument is that because the Copyright Clearance Center is willing to license these uses, there is in fact harm to the market. They also are making an argument that anything beyond the library privileges that are in Section 108 bears a heavy burden of proof that the use is fair. So we'll see. A win for Becker is going to enable educational uses of material by higher ed and research libraries. It would also probably help some of the educational use copyright claims in other contexts. For example, it would help to build the argument of fair use for digitizing orphan works. And a win for the for the Cambridge University Press will really help CCC a lot in developing a licensing market for university activities of this sort. A second case that's really significant is the Authors Guild versus HathiTrust case. The HathiTrust is a consortium of research library partners of Google. So the deal that was cut when the research libraries allowed their books to be digitized by Google was that the libraries would be able to get back from Google library digital copies of the works in their collection that Google scanned. And HathiTrust was formed so that the University of Michigan, the University of California, the University of Texas, University of Virginia, etc., could pool their library digital copies into one corpus, and then the members of the consortium and their faculty and students would be able to have some access to it. The Authors Guild is arguing that HathiTrust, University of California, and all the other partners are making infringing uses of the books, and HathiTrust won at the trial court level. The Authors Guild appealed, and the hearing on the appeal is scheduled for October 30th, so we'll probably know something important after the oral argument in terms of which way the court is leaning. The Authors Guild is making the argument that there's a commerciality of the use here because it was part of a bargain, right? The library supplied the books, and the exchange was they got back library digital copies, and that was a kind of commercial transaction. They're arguing that it's non-transformative in the sense that the books, the digitized books, are the same book as the book that was on the shelf. The nature of the work, they argue, is creative works of all genres. Whole works were copied systematically, stored permanently, and libraries are able to use copies of the books through HathiTrust. And they both want to make an argument that that you should presume harm because of the commercial nature of it, the lack of control that authors can exercise, the risk of loss from inadequate security, and we want to license these uses. And so that's kind of the nutshell of their argument. But HathiTrust won on fair use at the trial court level, and let me just talk a little bit about that. So one of the arguments that HathiTrust is making is that the copies of these books are being made for preservation purposes. They're not for in copyright books, you can't get access to the whole book. You can't even get access to snippets. All you can do is what you might call computational research. So if I'm looking for a particular historical event or a particular person that I'm studying, I can run a search across the 10 million books that are in the HathiTrust corpus, and I can find out the names of the books and the pages in those books that that tell me that this particular incident or this particular person is mentioned on that page. And so it's basically a research tool. The court found that data mining or computational research, digital humanities research, among other things, was actually fair use too. And a third purpose that HathiTrust argued that it was making of these books is that it is enabling enhanced access for print disabled people. So generally, you go to a library. If you're not a print disabled person, you can pull the book off the shelf and you can read it. If you're a print disabled person, you can't do that. So this then provides access to print disabled people in Braille, other kind of formats, the full text of the books, as long as you show that you in fact really are a print disabled person. The nature of the works, HathiTrust is arguing they're mostly nonfiction, out of print, and many of them are orphans. And yeah, the whole thing is copied, but it's reasonable in light of your purposes. You can't preserve the work unless you copy the whole thing. You can't enable the computational research unless you copy the whole thing. You can't provide enhanced access for print disabled people without that. So it's only it's reasonable in light of your purpose, and so that's okay too. And the impact on the market, the trial judge said, there's no quantifiable harm to date. The harm to future licensing markets is speculative, it's really prohibitively expensive to try to negotiate with each publisher and each author for rights to just preserve works, engage in computational research, etc. So Judge Baer wrote a very powerful opinion, and we'll see what the Second Circuit thinks about it. As you know, I'm sure, the question more generally of whether mass digitization is fair use is also being litigated in the Authors Guild v. Google case. Google is making a lot of claims about fair use, God bless them. That case is one pending now before the trial court. It's a long story. But the short version is that earlier this month, or within the last few weeks, there was an oral argument on the fair use issue, and Judge Chin, who's retained jurisdiction over the case since the settlement fell apart, seemed to be much more receptive to the fair use argument than he had seemed previously. So again, Google's arguing that the Google Book Search makes transformative uses of the books because it promotes better access to information. Most of the books in the Google corpus are scholarly nonfiction works, and so I think it's like 93% of them actually are scholarly nonfiction works, and most of them are out of print. So what's happening is Google is actually making access to those books possible now that weren't before. Yeah, I'm copying the whole thing, but that's necessary in order to index and make snippets available. And the transaction cost problem of clearing rights is also raised there. But Google's also arguing that it enhances the market for many books, partly because it has a little button where you can press here and then go to Amazon to buy the book. We'll see what happens. If the appellate court affirms in the HathiTrust case, that's going to mean that all manner of nonprofit libraries, educational institutions, and archives for that matter, will feel a lot freer to scan works for similar purposes. It's going to help Google's fair use defense, and I think it also strengthens the argument for making orphan works available, at least by nonprofit organizations. And it might even support library lending of e-books that have been scanned from their collections. So that's one of those other lurking issues out there on the on the horizon. And if the Authors Guild wins, the HathiTrust corpus, which now contains 10 million books, about 7 million of which are probably in copyright, is potentially in danger because copyright owners are entitled to impound and destroy infringing copies of works. And I think that would just be tragic. The Kurtzing versus Wiley case is a case the Supreme Court just recently decided. This actually has a little bit of a educational use aspect too. So Kurtzing was a graduate student in the United States. He was from Thailand originally. And he asked members of his family to go buy books that were published in English, not illegally made ones, in Thailand, and then ship the books to him in the United States, and then he'd sell them on eBay and otherwise, and that's how he paid for his graduate school expenses. How entrepreneurial of him. So Wiley sued him for copyright infringement and alleging that he unlawfully distributed copies of its works and unlawfully imported them. That was really, so he was saying, I bought them. So the first sale exhaustion defense applies, but the argument that was before the Supreme Court is whether or not the first sale doctrine applies only to books that were manufactured in the United States, or whether or not books that were lawfully sold in Thailand and then imported into the United States, are they subject to this first sale or exhaustion of rights doctrine? And at the trial court, he lost, and thanks to statutory damages, another one of my unfavorite subjects, Wiley was awarded $600,000 in damages. And this was 24 times, I think, the amount that he actually made from the sale of his books, and they took away his computer and his golf clubs in executing that judgment. And the Supreme Court recently ruled in Kurtzing's favor, saying that the first sale rule does apply to foreign books. That's really important because it means that libraries in the United States that have books in their collections that were originally from other countries can now feel free to lend them, right? The libraries actually put in a brief and said, oh my God, half of our collection is our books that were published outside the United States. We think that's really valuable to our researchers to have access to those things, but if you rule this way, then we won't be able to lend those books, and in fact, even having them on our shelves might be considered a distribution of a copy. And so they were really, really worried about it. So the Kurtzing's victory was a big victory for the libraries and research universities, too. Now, Capital versus Redigi raises an issue that's kind of been lurking out there for a while, and that is whether or not reselling digital copies of anything can be covered by the first sale rule or first sale coupled with fair use. So what Redigi does is basically it developed a software platform that allowed people who had music that they bought from Apple's iTunes store to resell those tunes, and what they would do is Redigi had a software platform with stuff in the cloud, and then they had a software that was loaded onto a reseller's platform, and then basically they as they transferred the bits into the cloud, they basically wiped them off the hard drive of the reseller, and then the reseller wouldn't be able to get cash for reselling that music, but if somebody else bought it, then they'd get a credit, and they could use that credit to buy other people's resold music. And so that was the kind of platform that they had. And once the thing is in the cloud, it's available for resale. Then somebody says, "Oh, I want that particular record, so I want to buy it," and then if you buy it, then you can either, it's only you that can then stream it from that server, or you can download it to your computer, but then it gets erased off the Redigi servers. Okay, so it's an effort to essentially recreate in the digital environment, a kind of resale of stuff. And I think you can see that the resale or the redistribution of books would also be something that could be done with such a platform. So Redigi said for sale or unfair use, and Capital said no, first sale is inapplicable because first sale only limits the distribution right, not the reproduction right, and you have to make copies in order to be able to resell this music. And the trial judge, in a decision that is not much to be admired, ruled for Capital Records. So that case will go up on appeal to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, too. So it's a really important case about whether the first sale principle applies at all in the digital environment. We'll see what happens with that. So one of the things to note is there are libraries out there digitizing out-of-print books and then lending them, like, for 2 weeks with DRM, and then the book disappears. The legality of that is actually unclear, and the Capital Records case would actually make it not easy to defend that, but that's one of the other things that's out there. Now, the next great Copyright Act has been announced, and Register Pallante wants to do a kind of comprehensive reform of copyright, and although some parts of her agenda are ones that people might be worried about, there are some parts that actually are friendly to higher ed. One is to facilitate greater access to for orphan works. Second, to facilitate more access for print-disabled people. Third is to update library and archive privileges. She wants to give some guidance to educational institutions, but I'll tell you what, bracket, I think she wants to do that through licensing, not through fair use or an exemption. She also is talking about an exemption for some incidental copies, although she doesn't say what. And the DMCA safe harbors that universities, among others, rely upon so that you don't have to monitor if there's infringing stuff going on your system. That safe harbor is one that the content industry didn't like back in 1998. And if you reopen that particular Pandora's box, it could end up not so good for universities, among others. So there have been hearings about this over the last several months, and Representative Goodlatte is leading the effort and seems to be intent on having another four hearings now that the budget crisis is at least averted for a while. Orphan works is a subject that is very important to the higher ed community because there are millions of works that are still in copyright where the rights holder is unknown or unfindable. The Copyright Office has recommended legislation to limit liability. A lot of the stuff that researchers at higher ed want to do are things that are actually orphan works, photographs and documents that might have been part of, for example, an early civil rights movement group. How would you know how to find the person who wrote this particular document? How would you be able to locate the photographer who took this particular photograph? So there's been a lot of movement around the world about orphan works lately, and I think it's especially difficult to track down rights holders for works that come from outside the United States. Anyway, we're making an argument in the work that my group at Berkeley has been doing that that once you have established that something's an orphan work, that actually fair use should be available for that. It's transformative because it increases access to knowledge. The nature of the work is it's an orphan, it's out of print, you can't find the rights holder, so how could there be any harm to the market? I think that's a pretty good argument. One of the things that many people worry about in relation to copyright policy, and maybe there are some of you in the audience who fall into that, is like, you don't want Congress to do anything because everything that they would do would be bad because they just do what Hollywood wants. I don't know that that's necessarily the right attitude, but it is the case that they're more influential, generally speaking, than we are. And part of the reason for that is that when it comes to thinking about authorship, And the Copyright Office and people like Representative Goodlatte don't recognize that universities are authorial communities, right? We write all the time. We create works of authorship all the time. And our interest in copyright is not just as users, but also as creators. And so our needs, our interests should be represented, I think, better than they have been to date. And I'm forming a new nonprofit organization to be called the Authors Alliance to represent the interests of kind of academics and other authors who just want our works to be available. As you know, the Stop Online Piracy Act was looked like it was going to steam down the track and then got derailed because 8 million people got in touch with members of Congress saying, no, don't do this. So it may be that the dynamics in the dynamics in Congress might have changed a little bit. Now, open access is a topic that is quite a lot of interest. There are lots of opportunities for sharing information nowadays. There are a lot of higher ed creators who are interested in sharing instead of restricting access. Conventional publishing is not needed in the way that they were before, and organizations like Creative Commons have helped to facilitate the idea of sharing in open access ways. There are a lot of obstacles to sharing open access. Legacy works is one of them. The mindsets of some authors is another. There are certain problems that certain creators have. There are sustainability and preservation issues that need to be tackled too. And I do have slides on each of these, but I'm just going to go and say, we got to actually make some progress by taking initiative ourselves. We can't be reactive. We need to be proactive. And promoting open access policies and repositories is really important. Convincing faculty not to assign copyrights or at least to fight back a little bit is really important. Policies that allow universities to retain a license to make faculty works available for educational uses is a good idea. New business models for university presses. I think there are number of ways that we can make progress, and I think we need to try to do that. So we have a big stake in copyright law and policy. There's some good news out there with some of the cases, and there's some reason to be optimistic, but we got to be proactive. We can't sit there and just say, oh, copyright, I don't want to think about it. Thanks very much. So I see us having about 10 minutes for questions here. There's a microphone in the center of the area here.
I'm curious how you see the Teach Act being affected.
I'm sorry, the what?
The Teach Act?
Yes.
Being affected by the new discussions around a major overhaul of the copyright law?
So I don't think that that's the set of issues that is on either Maria Palante's mind or on the mind of the people at the Department of Commerce who are essentially trying to formulate the Obama administration's position. I think that to the extent that higher ed wants to put that on the agenda, that's a place where taking some initiative would be a good idea. I think it's fair to say that there is some trepidation at the moment. A lot of people in the higher ed and library communities just want to hide when it comes to the next great Copyright Act because it sounds like it could be worse than the law that we have already. And so, you know, wanting to kind of then have expansive interpretation of fair use so that you don't need legislation. But I think that, you know, while it is sensible to be somewhat concerned about what would happen if Congress decided to reopen comprehensive copyright legislation, that it would be a mistake for higher ed not to at least try to say, if we're going to do this, these things need to be on the agenda, and these things are the things that map our interests. And so to the extent that that previous efforts to do something about long-distance education have not been entirely successful, then formulating a policy that would match better both the current environment and also hopefully would have enough flexibility built into it so that it doesn't become outmoded when the next technology cycle comes along. I think that's been one of the biggest challenges for people who are trying to think ahead, right? It's like, we know what the environment is today. It's easier to make decisions about what it used to look like 5 years ago. Maybe you can make it about today, but how can we keep it flexible enough so that as new types of learning platforms become available, that the same balancing mechanism can play itself out. But I think this is a place where there's some opportunity, again, for a proactive agenda, and so I would urge people to move forward with that.
You mentioned some things that are at the universities themselves, University Press's new business model, and University Press is, of course, backed the publishers, not the librarians in the Georgia State case, and encouraging faculty not to give away copyright. What kinds of changes would you suggest to accomplish those goals?
Well, so Harvard faculty passed a policy that gives Harvard University a non-exclusive license to make their works available for educational and research purposes. That's a policy that then, if a publisher says, you got to assign a copyright, so they say, I'm sorry, my university has a policy, it retains a non-exclusive license, I can't give you what you want. And it seems to me that that's actually a pretty good policy that then allows for open access to be done. MIT has done something similar. The University of California has recently adopted an open access policy, which allows people to opt out, but which puts some obligation to make things available in an open access repository. One of the things that that this Authors Alliance group that I'm imagining might do is help provide ideas to faculty about, here's some language you can offer as an alternative to what the publisher is asking for. It's often the case that publishers have a first request, which is, assign away all your copyright, I demand this. And if you say, no, actually that doesn't work for me, then they have actually a second policy, sometimes a little bit more favorable. And so learning to just push back a little bit, I think, is something that's important to do. And then part of what we want to do is create some competition also among publishers, so that if you find a publisher that actually has a more open policy. So I publish a lot in the communications of the ACM, a computing journal that some of you may be familiar with. And CACM has a policy that anything that's in a CACM journal is available for use without permission for educational purposes. I'd much rather publish with CACM because of that policy. And so helping to create this notion that it's a good thing. Now, publishers have moved some. There was a time when, oh, you can't put it on your homepage. It's like, excuse me, this is my work. You're not paying me for it. And so, you know, publishers now feel much more grudging, perhaps, but willing to accept that that authors have some interests that they want to pursue. And it's one of those things where, you know, 20 years ago, this wasn't really a problem because there wasn't a possibility of doing the open access thing. Now there is, and so again, I think we have to think creatively about how we can take advantage of the new opportunities that are out there and help encourage the development of policies that actually will serve our interests.
From the online audience. Sounds like many of the arguments boil down to expanded access being transformative use. Do you suspect this will be a successful argument with the current court?
Yeah, so there, the Supreme Court, in a case called Campbell versus Acuff Rose, endorsed the idea that transformative uses of copyrighted works were more likely to get fair use determinations. And that case involved two Live Crew's rap parody version of the Roy Orbison song Pretty Woman. And it was transformative in that instead of being kind of, oh, pretty woman, it was like, oh, dirty, hairy woman. And it wasn't, you know, it was kind of not very nice. But the court basically said it was a critical commentary on the original. And because of that, it was transformative, and therefore it was okay. But the court defined the term transformative in a way that said also that if it's used for a different purpose than the original, then it's transformative too. So one of the arguments that succeeded in the courts in a couple of cases involving search engines and the use of little kind of thumbnail images. So if you're looking, for example, for photographs of the Grand Canyon, there are these, you know, the search engines will pull up these little pictures that are like little teeny versions of the images, and then you can click through and see the better resolution image on somebody else's website. There was a lawsuit that claimed that making those thumbnails was actually copyright infringement, and the court said no, it's for a different purpose. It's for enabling better access to information. That's a different purpose than the picture of the Grand Canyon was taken for. So a lot of the sort of effort now to call things transformative in the educational use context is to say that it's being done for a different purpose. And the Cambridge University Press versus Becker is a case where actually Becker is not claiming that the uses are transformative. We, in an amicus brief that we filed, argued that actually there are some transformative nature arguments to be made in that, but transformativeness has turned into something that's kind of almost talismanic. And I think that we have to recognize that fair use may be more available for transformative uses, but doesn't necessarily undermine the fair use argument for some things that aren't transformative, that simply make works more available than they were before.
Some authors are opting into alternate open access, I guess, systems such as Creative Commons, where they can choose how something can be licensed outside of the traditional copyright model. Is there any evidence that U.S. courts or courts around the world are actually upholding those models if they were challenged within the legal system, if someone has broken one of those alternative models for licensing?
So I don't recall any cases talking about Creative Commons licensing. I think that there may be room for that at some point in the future. I think that Creative Commons licensing has created options and a sense of options. Of course, the problem is with a lot of the legacy works that are out there. I would have used Creative Commons with this article I wrote 10 years ago, but I didn't know that Creative Commons existed then. And so what do you do with the legacy works? That's a really important issue. You can't kind of go back and kind of like say, oh, well, publisher, I'm sorry, I meant to do this Creative Commons. You know, but I think one of the things that can happen, and certainly this is one of the points that we made in our brief in the Becker case, is that academic authors want their works to be more widely available. And so we would have made them available under Creative Commons licenses back then if we'd known that was possible. So it may be that the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals will take something like that into account. It's just difficult to predict, but Creative Commons definitely has opened up some space for choosing between kind of full-dress copyright with all the heavy armor that comes with that and kind of nothing. And so this kind of, it was a really creative idea.
I had a quick question. In regards to if someone produces, say, a novel type of work, something unique and original, and then someone else takes that work and makes something very commercial out of it, and the first person was just trying to give access to information. How does that kind of play out legally? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Sort of. I think so. To the extent that someone is making, let's say, a parody version of your thing and then selling it, the parody version might still be fair use, right? Because you're making fun of somebody, and if somebody's willing to buy the T-shirt with the, you know, with the parody of the non-commercial thing, then what are you going to do? But to the extent that it's just commercializing the underlying work, that's probably more troublesome. I mean, one of the things that Creative Commons has as an option is that you can make designate something to be a Creative Commons NC, which is a non-commercial license. So feel free to share this with people, and even to make mashups of it and the like, as long as it's for non-commercial purposes. But if you want to make commercial uses, then you have to come back to me, and you have to get my permission. And I think courts would enforce that. Does that help?
Yeah, it does a lot, actually.
Okay, thanks. I think this is actually timed up.
I think we're timed, yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Pam.